Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design. I'm your guest host, Ira Berkowitz, speaking to you from Jerusalem, Israel. With us this evening is Rabbi Moshe Averick, who also lives in Israel. He's the author of Nonsense of a High Order, The Confused World of Modern Atheism. His book makes cogent arguments for design based in science and philosophy and does it in a fresh, funny, in-your-face style. This interview builds on a previous set of podcasts done for ID the Future. Listeners can learn more about them by going to the ID the Future website and searching for Averick. That's A-V-E-R-I-C-K. Rabbi Averick, after your book and accompanying articles came out, people surprisingly raised that old ghost who designed the designer. Would you please put this ghost to rest?
Actually, the who designed the designer is an important question. But let's make sure that we state the argument clearly. The argument is like this. Look, if a bacterial cell needs an intelligent designer, then whoever designed the bacterial cell also would need an intelligent designer. And that designer would also need a designer. The argument sort of stands on its own. It makes sense. You're right. The intelligent designer of the bacterial cell, it would seem, does need an intelligent designer. So the problem is that you end up then with an infinite regress. That's the problem. That's the philosophical dilemma. And without going into detail, neither of us, neither me nor Richard Dawkins, will use Dawkins to represent, you know, the other side of this argument. None of us are prepared for many different reasons to accept an infinite regress of designers and creators. So therefore, what Richard Dawkins says is that because of this argument, the only possibility is that the first life somehow must have happened by itself because it couldn't have had a designer, because you can't have this infinite regress. The fact is, of course, the argument is very flawed because, number one, anytime you find something that is functionally complex, you always conclude that there is a designer. For instance, you find a cave in Spain with drawings on it. You look at an iPhone. If you're a SETI scientist and you started receiving Morse code messages from a galaxy a million miles away, you would conclude, oh my goodness, intelligent life on the other side of the universe. So you ask, well, wait a second. It can't be, because who designed the designer? Who created the creator? I don't know who designed the designer, but if I'm getting Morse code messages from a galaxy a million miles away, that means there's an intelligent being there somehow. The fact that I don't know who designed the designer doesn't change that. So when you look at a bacterial cell, it is obvious that this cell was designed. Who designed the designer? I don't know. The problem that you have to deal with when you talk about who designed the designer is not whether or not the bacterial cell indicates creative activity. It obviously indicates creative activity. The problem is, can you discover a designer before whom there is no other designer? And the answer to that question is, yes, we can. The God of Abraham, meaning the God of monotheism, the God who created time, space, matter, and energy, and who himself is none of those things. If that God exists, and please, I ask you, Ira, and the listeners to listen very carefully. If that God exists, well, we don't have a problem anymore, because there is no designer before this God or this being, because he doesn't exist in time. He created time. He started time. There is no before because there is no time. So now, if that creator exists, we've solved the problem. Which means that when Dawkins and other people raise this question, they haven't challenged anything. All they've done is restate the question again. Does God exist or not? Does the God who transcends the physical universe exist? And if he does, we don't have a problem anymore. And if he doesn't exist, well, of course he didn't create life. He doesn't exist. That's all they've done is restate the question.
Got it. Actually, we could be stricter about it too. We could say, we don't know. We don't know. There's a designer. Is there one before that? Okay. When we reach that one, we'll let you know what's going on.
Well, I don't know, because you cannot have it. We will not accept an infinite regress. So therefore, you've got to deal with this question head on. Now, we could go further with it because this is the question that really leads us to, in my opinion, to the conclusion that that absolutely, yes, this God exists. I don't know how much time we have here, and I don't know into how much detail we can go. But you can't hand wave that question away. The question itself is very real and must be dealt with.
Now, in your book, you make the point that we respond emotionally to words, whether spoken or written, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that response is an indication that something spiritual is going on inside us. I've got that right?
Yes.
Okay, so one of your critics has retorted that the physiological processes that produce thoughts and emotions are complex and impressive, but not mysterious. He says, quote, "Does Averick think that when these things are produced by electrical stimulation of the brain, the soul is being activated by the electrical current?" Your comment.
Well, he missed the point when he brings that up. The question is like this. For instance, I'm sitting here talking to you. You know, we're a few feet apart, and I'm making sounds, and I can say certain things about you. Let's say I knew certain, just to really make a clear example, let's say I knew certain things about your past that you didn't want anyone else to know. And I started telling all these secrets on, and let's say we're on a live broadcast and millions of people are listening. Your whole body chemistry would change. If we had monitors hooked up to your brain and to your heart, your respiration, probably certain indicators would start going wildly. You'd feel shame. Your throat would be constrict. You wouldn't be able to breathe. You know, you'd turn red, etc. What caused that reaction? Sounds coming from my mouth caused a physiological reaction in you. Well, what was the physical cause of that? I mean, the excitement of the air around me as I speak? What caused it? It's obviously not it's not the sound waves that caused it, because if I said it in a language that you didn't understand, you'd sit there looking at me like you wouldn't understand, you wouldn't feel anything. It's not the sounds. It's the ideas. It's the information that I shot across the room at you. And somehow that non-physical information, which has no chemical formula, no physical formula, doesn't take up any space or mass, somehow that caused a profound physical reaction in you. What was it? Obviously, the spiritual is affecting the physical. The physical and spiritual interact with each other. The physical can affect the spiritual, and the spiritual can affect the physical. So like I said, this guy missed the whole point.
Okay, but if there's electrical stimulation of the brain that has nothing to do with any content,
right,
we could get similar responses.
Yeah, you can, in other words, you can physically elicit a spiritual reaction also. That's all you've done, really. And in fact, what do you mean when you're thinking ideas? There is no scientist in the world who understands what a thought is. I poke your brain, I stimulate your brain, and all of a sudden I get images in my brain. I start thinking things. I start feeling things. Nobody understands what that is. Nobody understands what consciousness is. In other words, all you're telling me is that the physical and the spiritual interact with each other. That's all.
Okay, now just for the sake of fun, I'd like to quote some of the more extreme comments that people have made about you.
Okay.
Here's evolutionary biologist Jerry Coyne.
Quote, yeah, one of my favorite buddies.
Moshe Averick is not only a creationist and a liar, but a sexist.
Oh, my goodness. Well, what am I supposed to say to that? You know, Jerry found that, you know, what happened there really was that we had gotten entangled in a cross-internet kind of war with each other. I was writing articles, then he would write an article against it, then I would write an article answering his, and he would write it on his blog, and at the time I was writing a column for the Allgemeiner Journal, which is a Jewish news website. And what happened was, I think he got too entangled, and at one point I said to him, look, what are we fighting for? I live in Chicago. You're in Hyde Park. I used to hang out in Hyde Park growing up. It was one of my favorite places, at the University of Chicago, of course. I said, why don't we have a debate? Let's get together and let's have a meeting of the minds and have a debate. And I think he realized he was kind of stuck. because Jerry Coyne did not want to get in a debate about origin of life, because he knows as well as I do that he doesn't know anything about origin of life. So therefore, he found an excuse to get out of it. He called me a liar, a sexist, this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah, what got me is that he called you a creationist. It was like, you're a this, you're a that, and you're also a that.
Yeah, the creationist, for Jerry Coyne to call someone a creationist, it's like one step below being a Nazi. Maybe it's even worse in his eyes.
It might be. Okay, and the Encyclopedia of American Loons, I'm sorry for choosing this, but not actually I'm not that sorry, says that you are a massively deluded know-nothing who will still gleefully pontificate to those who do know something. Is
right.
that true?
Well, that when I saw that I had made it to the North American, what is it called again? The North American, is it Encyclopedia of Loons or something like that?
Encyclopedia of American Loons.
American
we
Loons.
We haven't included the Canadians and the Mexicans.
That was a proud moment in my educational career, because if that guy called me a loon, then I knew that I'd really made it. I'd made an impression on some people.
So it's gratifying to be listed there.
Oh, absolutely. For that guy to call me a loon is the greatest compliment you can get.
Yeah, Steve Meyer is in there, Michael Behe,
Lee Spetner. And I was a little jealous because Steve Meyer was higher up on the list than me.
Let's just call it inverse proportion. Okay, now for a more serious question. Why all the loud protests? Why are the ideas you're promoting so vehemently denied? Let's say that you are an American loon. Let's say you belong with the flat earthers, the UFO siders, and those who say the earth is hollow and filled with aliens. Did you ever hear that one? Shouldn't you simply be ignored with the rest of the kooks? What's so threatening about intelligent design, or even worse, an evidence-based case for theism?
That's actually a very good question. You're right. Because if it really was the same as flat earth, people would ignore it. They'd just laugh, and they wouldn't even bother wasting their breath on it. But the fact is they know that this is a real, real problem. They know that origin of life is the soft underbelly of atheism. The soft, completely vulnerable and unguarded underbelly of atheism. And they know that there are real problems with the theory of evolution. And a lot of people have fought very hard to push God out of the academic and intellectual world. And they don't want him back. You know, they're very happy not to have anyone telling them what to do. So there is a spiritual, psychological agenda going on here. There's no question at all. And that's why people get so upset.
Is it a power struggle?
You know what? Before I answer that question, let me tell you a story. The first time I spoke about origin of life, when I was finishing up the first draft of the book, I was invited to speak by the Secular Students Society of Elmhurst College. It's a small, very nice little campus outside of Chicago. And it was a closed meeting. I thought it was going to be open to everybody, but it was only the Secular Students Society, only those, about 30 or 40 people, students. So I spoke for about 45 minutes on origin of life. And I said, and now the most important part of the evening, it's your questions, please. And there was like dead silence. Now, I've been an educator for many years. You said 30 years before. It's getting close to 40 years now. And I know there's different kinds of silences when you're speaking to a group of people. Sometimes it's a silence because you've put everyone to sleep. This was not, everyone wasn't asleep. They were, I could tell, they were intimidated. I'm older than they are. I have thought out my ideas much better than them. And they didn't know what to say. And they were kind of sitting there, what do we say now to this rabbi? Finally, one guy raised his hand. And he goes, this was amazing. The first question at the first talk I gave, he goes, okay, Rabbi, maybe God did create life. That's what he said. It was so, I didn't show it, but I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. Any rate, he says, maybe God did create life, but that doesn't prove religion. And I said to him, you know what? You're absolutely correct. It's clear that God created life, but divine revelation, religion, that's a totally separate topic, and they should be kept separate. And in any case, so I think that idea also should be emphasized, that because, you know, God exists, it doesn't mean that you have to start keeping kosher or you have to start going to church, at least not yet, okay? So in any case, I think that really answers your question.
Very much so. That's really chapter two. Religion is really chapter two. Okay, now let's reverse the question. What's so threatening about atheism? Let's say your atheist detractors grant you that atheism leads to moral relativism. They'll counter that theism produces intolerance and worse. What do you say to them?
Well, there's different ways of approaching that. In the ultimate sense, the danger of atheism is that it's not true. You know, it's clear to me God does exist and God is real. And our lives are bound up with this quest to seek him somehow. What's wrong with moral relativism? Well, let's say that I actually agreed with them. And I said, yes, atheism is the truth. There is no God. Well, I wouldn't be wasting my time arguing with anyone. What do I care anymore? What difference does it make? One of the most incredible statements that Christopher Hitchens made, which sort of gets lost. Most people didn't realize what he said. And they don't understand how important it was. He said to someone who asked him a question from the audience, this was from a lecture he gave at Sewanee University in Tennessee. He said, look, for me, the question would be that if there is no purposeful creation, then why care? Why bother? And then he goes, and there is no conclusive answer to that question. And you know what? He's almost right. There's no answer at all to that question. Why should you care? If there's no purposeful creation, why should you care? Why would I write a book if it doesn't matter anyways? There's no purpose to it. So, by the way, this is the sort of the schizoid attitude of atheists that they talk about a world where there is no ultimate purpose and yet they're all seeking purpose. There's something comical about it, by the way.
I agree. Sadly comic, but comic. Well, Rabbi Averick, we've reached the end of our podcast. It's always a pleasure talking with you. And if our listeners want more of the inimitable Rabbi Averick, they can read his book, Nonsense of a High Order, The Confused World of Modern Atheism, available from Amazon. This has been Ira Berkowitz for Intelligent Design, The Future. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.